Welcome to a Juno Afternoon. I'm your host, Scott Burton, and it's Monday, May 21st, 2018. On today's show, we'll learn about how to study the science of Stephen Hawking at the planetarium. We'll hear about the Juno Chamber of Commerce Golf Tournament and your chance to win a new car or a bunch of cash if you can make a hole in one. And we'll listen to a story from one of our fellow community members. Those interviews, National Native News, Bird Note, music, and more right here live and local on a Juno afternoon. It's currently 52 degrees here in the capital city, with winds out of the southeast, be around 23 miles per hour with gusts up to 35.
This is National Native News. I'm Art Hughes in for Antonio Gonzalez. A panel advocating for treaty hunting and fishing rights for 11 Ojibwe tribes say they want more say in Wisconsin's plan to control chronic wasting disease from game farms. Representatives of the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission say they've been pushing for tighter controls for years. Wisconsin Public Radio's Daniel Kading reports.
As early as 2004, the commission sought to prevent the spread of CWD-infected deer carcasses to unaffected areas and the transfer of animals on or off game farms. Executive Administrator Mick Isham says tribes have also been pushing for double fences on deer farms for years.
To me, the data has shown that the deer farms and the moving of these deer have had a real impact on the spread of this disease.
Isham says tribes should be involved in managing the disease. Earlier this month, Governor Scott Walker issued a plan to control its spread by requiring double fencing, banning movement of live deer from CWD-positive farms, and banning the movement of deer carcasses from CWD-affected counties. Deer farmers have said Walker's plan could put them out of business.
That's Wisconsin Public Radio reporter Daniel Kading. A decision by the U.S. Supreme Court is pending on whether to take up two cases involving Oklahoma tribes. The Oklahoman reports the high court asked the U.S. Solicitor General to weigh in on the Osage Nation's legal challenge of a wind farm on tribal land. The tribe says the wind farm developers should be required to obtain mineral permits in order to excavate land for the wind turbines. The high court's request to the Solicitor General is seen as an indication it will decide to take up the case. The court is also weighing whether to consider the death sentence of Muscogee Creek Nation member Patrick Murphy. He was convicted and sentenced for murdering another tribal member in 1999. The Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals unanimously vacated his death sentence last August, agreeing with Murphy's attorneys that the crime committed by a tribal member on what was historically tribal land should have been tried in federal court, not state court. A decision in Murphy's favor could have wide-ranging implications for other crimes committed on historically tribal land in Oklahoma. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled against the Upper Skagit Indian tribe in a land dispute in Washington state. The tribe argued it was immune from a lawsuit brought by a property owner over the location of a fence between the property and 40 acres purchased by the tribe. The Upper Skagit insisted the fence was in the wrong location. The Washington state Supreme Court ruled in favor of the tribe. The Supreme Court, however, says the court's reasoning is flawed and directed justices to take another look at the case. Some areas along the Okanagan River in Washington state remain under evacuation advisories by the Emergency Services Department for the Colville Confederated Tribes. Water levels are slowly receding after peaking over the weekend in some areas. Some tribal members used to natural disasters, however, are choosing to ride out the flood. Esme Jimenez reports.
For many locals, floods are another part of life in a county that also deals with drought and wildfires. Colville tribal member Don Abrahamson remembers dealing with the aftermath of the last major flood in 1972 when he was 14.
We just had to come clean up mud, and there's mud everywhere.
Now Abrahamson and his family of five are under a level 3 flood evacuation notice. Their backyard in Omak is partially underwater. The hardest part is waiting, says his wife Sabrina.
You're on a roller coaster because you're thinking, okay, I'm fine, and then you get another report, no, you're not. It's just not knowing that is the frustrating part about it.
The family is prepared to leave if the water does rise more, but for now, they're waiting it out.
It's just part of nature. You got no control over nothing, so just got to do whatever you can to protect yourself.
While they wait, they've sat on their back porch watching otter, beaver, and carp in their backyard.
You can see them swimming out there. Yeah, they're ugly-looking fish.
In Omak, yeah. I'm Esme Jimenez.
With National Native News, I'm Art Hughes.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Quantic Broadcast Corporation. funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Support from AmeriCorps Vista, whose members fight against poverty while earning money for college and gaining skills, with rewarding service opportunities around the country and info at AmeriCorps.gov/Vista. Support by BNSF Railway, moving our economy for over 165 years. Our vision is to operate injury and accident-free with safety programs, training, and technology. More at bnsf.com/tribal relations.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Intro here in the studio on a Juno afternoon. We have Steve Kosas. He is a board member over at the Marie Drake Planetarium. We're going to be talking about a talk on Stephen Hawking tomorrow, Tuesday, at 7 p.m. Welcome to a Juno afternoon, Steve.
Thank you, Scott. This is Steve. I'm the secretary of the nonprofit that runs the Marie Drake Planetarium. We're called the Friends of the Marie Drake Planetarium. And our mission statement is to provide free astronomy education to the public, which is what we're doing tomorrow at 7 p.m.
All right. The focus of the talk is Stephen Hawking. Why Stephen?
Well, he died this year, and he was the most famous scientist in the world, so we're going to talk about why.
Yeah, give us a few points as to why.
Well, he has two major books out, the technical book that he published in 73, with the co-author George Ellis, is called The Large-Scale Structure of the Universe, and you have to have graduate degrees in mathematics to read that book. It's unreadable by lay people. But his other book he wrote for lay people, A Brief History of Time, I believe sold at least 10 million copies, and I don't know how many languages it was translated into. But in fact, he's written some other books that are all kind of sequels to Brief History of Time. And I know there's a film by Earl Morris based on The Brief History of Time. So those are the two books he's known for, the technical book, Large Scale Structure of the Universe, and the book for the layperson, Brief History of Time.
Theoretical physicist, cosmologist, would you say mostly author? Stephen Hawking, how would you?
Well, he was mainly an astrophysicist, a cosmologist. He has quoted that he wanted to understand why the universe is and how it started. And he has more than 200 published scientific articles and many conferences. And probably his most famous scientific discovery, which is named after him, and Bekenstein, is Hawking radiation. It's properly called Hawking-Bekenstein radiation.
It's related to black holes, right?
Exactly. Up till 1973, when Hawking published his paper, it was thought that black holes were basically cold, that they did not emit any electromagnetic radiation. But Hawking showed that they do emit electromagnetic radiation. And to show that mathematically, he had to combine quantum mechanics, which is the scientific theory of the very, 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 very small, and general relativity, the scientific theory of the very large. And he was the first person to accomplish that in a rigorous way.
Okay. You described him as, again, a theoretical astronomer or in a cosmologist?
Well, he's more of a mathematical physicist, okay. I guess, if you want to pin it down exactly.
And how would you describe yourself?
Well, my background is in mathematics. I have graduate degrees in math, but I'm nowhere near the work that Stephen Hawking did. I did mostly applied math when I was, but I'm retired now.
What turned you on to his teachings and his work?
Well, anyone who's interested in astronomy, and I am, has heard of Stephen Hawking and his, I mentioned his work on Hawking radiation and black holes. Which, actually, let me just mention really quickly, that would be what he could have won the Nobel Prize for, his work on Hawking radiation. But as it turns out, he has a very rigorous mathematical description of Hawking radiation, but it has not been observed. An example of that is Peter Higgs in the 50s did mathematical structures for what's called the Higgs boson, but it was 50 years before the Higgs boson was observed, and that's when he was awarded the Nobel Prize for physics. And the Nobel Prize for physics isn't rewarded until whatever phenomenology is described mathematically is observed. So Hawking radiation is described mathematically, but it's not been observed. So that's why Hawking did not win the Nobel Prize.
Okay. Thinking about tomorrow night, your presentation on Stephen Hawking, 7 o'clock at the Murray Drake Planetarium. How are you going to present this? What's it going to look like?
Well, we have a computer system and a brand new projector, so we're going to show visualizations of Hawking's ideas, both Hawking radiation and his no boundary conditions for the universe and his singularity theorem. So we'll show that visually because they're all very abstract mathematics, but using computer-generated images, you can describe it as a cartoon, basically.
And so this is set up for the layperson.
Yes, exactly. We're not going to go into the partial differential equations and differential geometry and topology that Hawking used for his theorems, but we're going to show it visually.
All right. If somebody has never been to the Murray Drake Planetarium, how would you describe how to get there?
Well, we're at 1415 Glacier Avenue downtown, and we're right behind the artificial turf field. They're surrounded by that, 10-foot-high fence? And so there's some glass doors right into the Murray Drake building. We're right there at the entrance.
Across from the cemetery, close to the pool, close to
true.
The high school.
That's all true.
Okay.
What Scott said is all true.
It starts at 7. Is there a cost?
No, we do our shows free. That's part of our mission statement. And after we do the talk on Stephen Hawking, we'll use the Spitz projector, Maine, Pennsylvania, 50 years old, to show the stars tonight as the night sky would look like in Juneau if it was a clear night. And let me just mention quickly, our projector is 50 years old. It still works fine. It's an analog mechanical optical projector. But we currently have a fund drive to purchase a new digital system to replace the analog system when it does break down.
I mean, the Spitz projector, I've been hearing about this for years. It's legendary. Can digital do as good a job?
Made in Pennsylvania. Well, what's interesting is the Spitz projector has very, very well-defined star imagery, but everything is Earth-centered. So you only see the night sky as seen from the Earth. But as we know, digital systems are more versatile, so you can see images anywhere in the database. So in other words, you can see the stars as seen from Jupiter, from the Moon, or from another star system like Alpha Centauri.
Oh, that's interesting.
So that's the difference.
And speaking of that, you're going to be doing a presentation. Your next presentation is on the Moon, right?
That's right. Next month, June 12, we're going to do a presentation on our companion, the Moon. So we'll cover lunar eclipses and lunar phases and why we don't have an eclipse every new moon and full moon and other interesting aspects of the moon and why the moon was very important for life on Earth. So that'll be June 12th.
So we've had some good weather in the last couple of weeks here and there, some clear skies. Have you been out? Anything that you've been trying to see? Anything that we should be looking for in the night sky should it come back?
Well, actually, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn are visible. Mars is at opposition, so it's the red object in the sky. But interesting enough, when we had the clear nights, we did have some northern lights. Even though we're in midnight twilight, as we all know, midnight twilights from April to August, and we did have some visible northern lights. I can actually see them from my driveway in the valley. But any dark spot, even this time of year when we have midnight twilight, you can still see the northern lights. And you can get a forecast for them from the University of Alaska Fairbanks website as a forecast.
May I ask, what is it that sends you out at night to look at the sky? Where did this interest come from in your life?
Well, ever since I was young, I actually built my own telescope when I was a teenager, an 8-inch reflector, and I just had an excellent teacher who motivated me to be interested in astronomy. And also, I was very fortunate when I went to senior high school in Medford, Oregon. We had a planetarium there, and I worked as a lab assistant in the planetarium in Medford, Oregon. In fact, the projector in Medford, Oregon is a Spitz projector. It's the same model as the one here.
And when you're looking up at those planets or the stars, what are you thinking about?
Well, I'm thinking about the beauty of it and basically the awe that it generates within me, about how large the universe is. But it also, in the darkness then, the stars are my friends. I know the names of the constellations and the stars, so I feel more comfortable in the dark knowing that.
You're listening to the voice of Steve Kosas. He is a volunteer at the Murray Drank Planetarium, volunteer board member, I should say, or secretary?
I'm the secretary of the board. Our president is Christina De La Rosa.
All right. And you're going to be leading the discussion tomorrow night on Stephen Hawking.
Yes, and it's definitely a discussion. When I give the talk, I try to make it very informal so anyone can ask questions. And I'm sure there'll be a lot of questions because the work of Stephen Hawking's is actually very abstract mathematics. So like I said, we're going to use computer images to illustrate it.
And it's free.
It's free.
7 p.m. Tuesday night, the Murray Drake Planetarium by the Turf Field, which is by Juno Douglas High School and Evergreen Cemetery right in there.
Yeah, all are welcome, all ages. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. If we want information online, where should we go?
We have a website with all the information on our shows, MurrayDrakePlanetarium.org.
All right. Thanks so much for coming on the show, Steve.
And thank you, Scott.
Hi, this is Lauren with Juneau Parks and Recreation. Splash into summer with Juneau Pools. Take advantage of our new $129 summer swim pass for all ages, providing admission for lap and open swims, tot time, channel walking, water fitness classes, and more. Valid May 1st through October 1st. Remember, head over to Augustus Brown during Diamond Park's annual closure, May 6th through 22nd, and enjoy Friday night moonlight swim. Visit us at junopools.org and like us on Facebook.
Support comes from Alaska Litho, dedicated to delivering personal customer service to Southeast Alaska businesses for 70 years. Alaska Litho uses innovative technology to support businesses. More information about their print, social media, and website services at aklitho.com.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, May 21st, 2018. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 23 minutes past the top of the hour. We have a little extra time on the show today. Here is a story from Mudrooms, January 9th, 2018. The theme was Fork in the Road. Here is Jessica Bogard.
Our next speaker tonight is Jessica Bogard. Jessica Bogard has been told she has too many Legos, shoes, books, and knives. Lies. She believes you can never have too many of any of those. She also believes you can never have too many board game buddies interested in playing sometime. Let her know. Please welcome to the stage, Jessica.
So I'm Jessica Bogard, and my fork in the road was the moment I decided to become a people person. Yeah, not a full people person, like a three-quarter people person. You can round up on days when I feel like everyone's really interesting, and I can round down and read a book alone on the days that I decide it's a bad idea. Now, the fork in the road was because I had decided that being a professional hermit was a wonderful idea. I would read way too many books, according to my family, and my cousin one summer, sophomore year of college, decided to put me on a 12-step anonymous program for being social. I recently texted her to see if I had successfully completed the program, and she informed me no. I stalled about step 10, so it would be kind of two steps up, three steps back. I could read Harry Potter, but not in public. If people asked me a question, I had to follow up with a question about them, because apparently that's polite. Rules. So what I also learned on this fork in the road when I decided to be a three-quarter people person was that I had always been the person people talked to, which led, I think, to some of my not liking people. I would get off the subway in foreign countries and have a wheelie bag with me, because sadly I was that person, for which I apologize. I now have a backpack, which I would then understand why you'd ask me how to get somewhere. But they asked with the wheelie bag. They also asked when I was in New York with a cousin who lived there. But they wouldn't talk to him. Oh, no, no. They talked to me. I didn't like this. I really found this weird. But the fork in the road moment is when I decided I would accept this reality and make it work for me. Now, how it works for me is on the days when I decide that people are interesting, I don't mind everyone talking to me. But baby steps, right? So, for example, I have friends who don't believe me that everyone talks to me, and then they walk with me through the streets of Juneau. For example, tonight, three people. A man dressed as a wolf, who shook his tail at me. A man smoking, who commented on the weather, pretty good. And another man who growled, not dressed like a wolf. And my friends wanted to know what was in the air. That was the newer friend. The one who's been around for a while went, oh, we're with Jessica. You just accept it. Or if you're my cousin from New York, you decide which ball cap is the most offensive to whichever location we are in, and he wears it. He has decided that the New York Yankees hat is basically a sign that you're to the rest of the country. So that's what he rolls with when we're in San Francisco, Texas, Alabama, and anywhere else. Now, this only works in the continental United States because I went to school in a football town for grad school, which was Oklahoma, where you can actually yell boomer and everyone will yell sooner, unless they're from OSU and lost. Well, this just made it worse. And that's when I finally accepted it fully that it wasn't going to go away. So I have made it work for me in the fact that I now find people I think are interesting, walk up to them, and declare that we're going to be friends. So far, it's worked. Every time. But I also have moments where people still talk to me, and I'm like, I really would be okay with still believing I could marry Neville Longbottom and retire as a professor at Hogwarts. Again, apparently not a thing. So if you see me out and about, know that I did pick the fork that led me to being okay with you all talking to me. And most of the time, I'm really okay with that happening. But I think, like my introduction says, the fun thing about accepting the path was that I get to be interactive with everyone. And you get to have fun moments over board games or talking about knives. Because, again, it's me. Or having people dressed as wolves shake their tail at you. You just roll with it. So, thank you.
Do you enjoy eating fresh, high-quality local foods and supporting your community? Then you should check out the Salt and Soil Marketplace, Southeast Alaska's online farmers market connecting producers from all over Southeast Alaska to Juneau residents. You can choose from a wide range of goods grown and produced right in the community, all with the convenience of online shopping. The marketplace is open every week, Friday through Wednesday. Then pick up your order on Thursdays from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. downtown or in Lemon Creek. Sign up, support your community, and eat local. Find out more at saltandsoilmarketplace.com.
You're listening to a Juneau Afternoon here on Monday, May 21st, 2018. Scott Burton, your host, and we are right at the bottom of the hour. Joining us here in the studio is Ben Brown and Charlie Williams. They are both on the Juneau Chamber of Commerce. We're going to be talking about the commerce itself and also a golf tournament where you can win a new car or a bunch of cash or a bunch of Alaska Airlines miles, right, guys?
Yeah, all you have to do is hit a hole-in-one. It's really very, very approachable.
Yeah, exactly.
But the more important thing is it supports a good cause, Scott, and it's a lot of fun.
So it supports the Juneau Chamber of Commerce, right?
Yes. The Greater Juneau Chamber of Commerce is a wonderful organization that's been in existence since long before statehood and has existed as chambers of commerce do to bring together the community and specifically the business community so that people are aware of the beneficial economic impact of having strong businesses. And you know these small businesses, Charlie is a small business owner, Valley Pate Center, are the backbone of our community. And your employer, Capital Community Broadcasting Incorporated, is a member of the Chamber of Commerce.
Exactly. The Chamber of Commerce is actually the group that lobbies on behalf of businesses and helps them with some of the things that small business couldn't do on their own. And so by supporting small businesses, they help us to do a better job of being a small business.
What might be an example of a small business you guys have helped here in the community?
Well, recently we had an issue where one of our members wanted to get some work done at the airport that was kind of having its... They were dragging their feet a little bit. I wouldn't say dragging their feet. There were things that were being obstacles and for the airport board, and so we met with the board, and, we helped to move them along. They move on their own volition, but we certainly were a strong voice to help them to see that there was a need to move forward.
Another example is the Capitol, keeping the Capitol in Juneau. The Juneau Chamber has always been on the right side of that argument and a big supporter of the Alaska Committee, making sure that Alaskans across the state know that it would be economically senseless to move the capital and that it would cause tremendous damage to Juneau and all of Southeast and provide very little benefit to everyone else. Yeah. So that's another really important example. And then, Scott, one more that pops to my mind is there's a small business owner downtown who was recently concerned, brought his concern to us that only nonprofits could advertise on city buses. And having a for-profit business, he thought, why is my business not entitled to pay money to the city to help offset the cost of providing public transportation and get the word out that my business has goods and services to offer? So we were happy at the chamber to say, no, we're going to send a letter to the city and explain that we don't think that's a good policy.
Basically, anything that includes economic development falls under the purview of the Chamber of Commerce. So we see a lot of things that that help people come through our doors.
About how many of you are there on the chamber?
On the chamber board there, we are an 11-member board now.
Correct.
And I think all of our seats are currently filled.
They are. We have approximately, I think, 400 and some separate members, everything from capital members down to individual memberships.
I'm actually an individual member, but my employer, the Juneau Arts and Humanities Council, is also a member. And law firms, you know, doctor's offices, all the way up to our largest members, you know, Avista Corporation.
Yeah. Heckler Greens Creek or
the Tlingit Haida, Central Council of Indian Tribes, yep. Juneau Empire, Alaska Airlines. So it really ranges from individuals, small one-man, one-woman proprietorships to small businesses all the way up to large multinational corporations that feel like their investment in Juneau means that they should be chamber members. I will say, as the Chamber Membership Committee Chairman, not everyone who should be a member is a member. So if you're listening and you're not, I'm very
easy to find. There's a shameless plug for you.
Exactly. Because we want to make sure, you know, because we don't get any city money. Right. Our operations are paid for through chamber dues and then through events like the golf tournament that help us be able to afford the staff.
And when you're a member, you have an automatic venue for venting for your frustrations when it comes to working with the city, working with the state, working with regulations, doing all the things that are very difficult for small businesses to focus time on.
Where and when do you all meet?
Every Thursday at the Moose Lodge in the off season, in the interim, and then we move downtown during the legislative session.
Right. Exactly.
Okay. So to support all of this is on June 2nd, is that right?
Yes, Saturday the 2nd of June.
We're having a golf tournament, and it's a best ball scramble. And you're looking at me like, that's
scrambled.
Like, what the heck is that?
Yeah, this is public media here. Charlie, tell us about golf.
So a best ball scramble starts out with a team of four people teeing off. Each individual hits their tee off shot, and then the team members collectively decide which shot is the second shot that they want to use. So three people will pick up their ball, move to that spot where they've chosen to play from, and continue until they hole out or, you know, get the ball into the hole.
So it's very social, very collective. See,
yes.
That's very public media.
Yes.
Yeah. It's collaborative, and it's you know, using the strengths of your strongest member, but there are rules. You can't have one ringer and the team can't decide to use his or her shot every time. Yeah.
Yes. It's not that difficult, though. And I would encourage people who are golfers know this. I would encourage all people who are not even golfers, they'll have a great time with this and a lot of chances to win.
And it's at the Menino Golf Club right here by the airport.
Absolutely, yep.
Now, yep, 7 o'clock in the morning is our first tee-off time. And the way people will sign up is go to the Juneau Chamber's website, and there will be a link right on the homepage. Jump over there, and you can sign up as a single person, as two people, or as a whole team of four. It's $75 per person or $300 per team. And the earlier you sign up, the better the time. You know, there's more times available for you to choose from. So 7 till 2 on, and if you don't have time to get out there and play a whole round of golf that day, we also have what we call our Hole 10 Challenge. And the Hole 10 Challenge, basically we have a hole-in-one opportunity where you could win free Alaska Airlines tickets to anywhere Alaska Airlines flies, or 50,000 air miles. If nobody gets a hole-in-one on that hole, somebody will win the 50,000 miles. And then additionally, we have a bunch of prizes for little chipping contest where, you know, you try and chip a golf ball into a wheelbarrow or an ice chest or various other types of things, and we have tons and tons of prizes for that. And I do want to mention that you know, all these activities are sponsored by businesses, by local businesses. And I don't know, is it all right if I shout out to those businesses?
You may.
Well, we've got, of course, the Juno Radio Center. They're a sponsor, a key sponsor for our golf tournament. We have Alaska Marine Lines. We have LG Rayfield, Hecla Greens Creek. We have Shattuck and Grumman, McGivney's, Alaska Seaplanes, the Nugget Alaska Outfitters. They're sponsoring a very fun hole because that hole is a minefield of opportunities. So especially if you're not a really great golfer, if you miss the green, there's a good chance you might land on a prize. So and then we have on hole nine is that Jeep Compass that you can win, a $30,000 Jeep Compass by sponsored by Mendenhall Auto Center. And I might mention on hole eight, if you get a hole in one, not only do you get some prizes from the Nugget, but you also have you will also be able to win two cruise tickets on Carnival Cruises. So,
okay, if somebody's never been to the golf course, how would you describe to get there?
You'd be going out the road on Egan Drive, and you'd make a left on Industrial Boulevard, follow it to the end where it ends, and there will be a gate on your right. You follow through that gate, and you're there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, so if you get out to Swampy Acres, you've gone too far. You need to turn around and head back, and then turn between Don Abel and the Sandbar. That's Industrial.
Right, and we'll have signs out. We'll have banners out on the road that day because there will be people that may not have time to play the golf tournament but can stop by for the Hole 10 Challenge and for just a few dollars get a chance to win some great prizes.
And do you want to talk a little bit, Charlie, about where we're going to wrap up and talk about how the day went at the end of the day?
Yeah, the end of the day, at our last golfers will finish up around 4 o'clock, and so we'll have a little end of the day party and announce our winners and award our trophies. And you do not need to be present to win this year. So, but that's when we'll do it.
Okay, and so just, again, with best ball golf, let's imagine the three of us were on the first hole, and mine goes into the trees, which it would every time. Charlie, you get it 3 feet from the green. Ben, you're pretty close, but you're just off the green. We would all go probably to yours.
Well, we would choose which one has the best angle, which one has the right distance. You know, sometimes closer isn't always the best.
Right. If let's say there's 6 inches of standing water.
Yeah.
But it's closer to the hole. Then,
we're going to pray for good weather on that day, Ben.
Exactly. Well,
about that water.
I've never seen 6 inches of standing water. Okay, that would be a big lie. It's going to be nice and sunny in early June. But so, yeah, basically you pick the best shot, and it's not just from the tee, but each shot you're like, and then you have to use a number of shots, a minimum from each of the four players.
Just one shot from...
So we have pretty relaxed rules. One from each. So that basically means it is a very collective, collaborative effort.
Yes.
And if your shot is bad, if you pick it up, or in your example, Scott, you never see that ball again, you just forget about it.
Well, you know, don't talk so negative. You know, I know several people who have had birdies the first time they went out and played golf. I even know one lady who, on her very first round of golf, hit a hole in one.
That's pretty amazing. I never have, and I probably played my first game of golf when I was just big enough to hold a golf club with my dad many, many, many years ago. But one thing about golf is people tend to get worse when they take it too seriously. I can definitely say
this is not a serious. This is a fun
event. Right, because if you get serious and you get all stressed out about it, you know, that's where people like throw clubs and hurt themselves.
Yeah.
If it's a best ball scramble with happy hour at the end of the day and a hole-in-one, it's like just have a good time and kick back and laugh, and it's a lot more fun.
You know, get a team of your friends. That's one of the best ways to ensure you have a great time. And do just that. Laugh and have a good time.
So as of now, is there still room for plenty of sign-ups?
There is. We're only about half full right now, so we have another week and a half to go. Well, a week from Saturday, and you know, plenty of time, and there's quite a few signups available.
And I will just say, I know that night is the Juno Symphony's Shaken Not Stirred. So what a great way to spend your Saturday, the first Saturday in June. Golf all day, and then go listen to James Bond music at night.
Yeah.
That's what I'm thinking of doing. So I just want to plant that seed, if you will.
I think that's a great idea.
Right. There's a martini in between some there. Yeah, so anyhow.
All right, so it's June 2nd from 7 a.m. to 2 p.m. It's the Juno Chamber of Commerce Golf Tournament. Remind us of the website, where we can sign up.
It's. I don't know the exact website. Do you know, Ben? I think you just search for Juno Chamber, and you'll find it.
JunoChamber.com.
Is it?
I believe it's that. But you can call Heidi at 563-3488.
Yes.
That's the chamber office, and Heidi's our executive assistant, and she would be happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, and some people would like to even sign up with their businesses, and she can actually help them to do that, too. So.
Right. But you can definitely pick a fun name. If people want to have costumes, that's certainly permitted. This is about...
it's encouraged.
All right, there you go. It's not just permitted, it's encouraged. But this is about having a good time and supporting the chamber, because we want to have the resources to continue to advocate for the entire community through the business community.
And what's the cost per person and per team?
It's $75 per person or $300 per team.
And this all supports economic development in Juneau.
Yes.
All right, guys. Thanks for coming on the show. Call Heidi at 463-3488. Is that right?
That's right. That's
or
right.
Just search for Juneau Chamber of Commerce.
All right.
The golf tournament, June 2nd. 7 a.m. to 2 p.m. We've been speaking with Ben Brown and Charlie Williams. Thanks, guys. Anything else you want to add?
Just thank you, Scott. And come on out and join us for a lot of fun and support our chamber.
That's right. See you on the links.
Listening to a Juneau afternoon here on Monday, May 21st. It's about 14 minutes till the top of the hour. And we do have a little more extra time here on a Juneau afternoon. So here's another mudroom story for you. This is Riley Woodford from February 13th, 2018. It's the close quarters themed edition of Mudroom.
Our next speaker is Riley Woodford. Riley moved to Juneau in 1985. Like most folks in their mid-20s in downtown Juneau, he shared houses with housemates in close quarters living while enjoying the wide open spaces outdoors. He loved the old houses built close together on streets so steep that the sidewalks are staircases. In 1992, he moved into a small, uniquely situated barn red house on 3rd Street, beginning a chapter in a tale of close quarters living that you will hear tonight. Riley.
So for 12 years, I lived downtown next door to the Bergman Hotel. The Bergman Hotel is a boxy, four-story hotel on the corner of 3rd and Harris. And I lived right next door to it. The houses were really close together. It was built on the property line. And if you walked from my front yard to the backyard between the buildings, you could touch both buildings all the way back. It was like a short hike through a slot canyon. And if you stood in my backyard and looked up, there were 18 big windows, big curtainless, screenless windows. 9 of them were above my roof, and 9 of them were above my backyard. And if you were up, say, on the 4th story, looking out of one of those windows, you didn't even see my house down below. You just looked out over town and the harbor, and if you flicked a cigarette, it would fly completely over my roof into my neighbor's yard. But if you dropped something, it would go, you know, down onto my roof or into the slot canyon or maybe into my backyard. So I know, you know, some people in this room have maybe peed off of a dock or a deck. Or maybe some of you have even peed out of the 4-story window of a hotel onto the asphalt shingle roof of a house 25 feet below. And it's really loud. It's really loud. But if you're in that house under that roof, it's like somebody is running a garden hose on a drum head. So that was my first introduction to the things that would come out of the windows of the Bergman. So there was a restaurant in the back of the Bergman on the first story, Pat's Grub Steak. So the week I moved in October of 1992, the deep fat fryer broke down in the Grub Steak. And it was about the size of a dorm fridge. So it fit through the window, and they pushed it out the window into the backyard. And that was how I met Pat. I went over and said, hey, could you come and get this deep fat fryer? And I got the answer that I would get for the next 12 years, the answer that anyone in the neighborhood, everyone got anytime we went to the Bergman and asked anything, and that was, sure. And then nothing would ever happen. So after about 4 months, a friend came over, and we pulled that thing out of the big puddle of coagulated grease, drug it around the back of the hotel and leaned it up against the side of the building with all of the other broken appliances and soggy mattresses that had been leaned up back there. So now I had this big puddle of coagulated grease to deal with and all of this other organic matter that was raining out of those windows. So I just composted it. I just thought, I'll make a compost. And so I shoveled in half-eaten ramen and regurgitated takeout and condoms and everything. And there were things that were lost out of the windows, too. Like, I composted cocaine, and I composted Dear John letters. Everything went into the compost. But it wasn't all bad. I found a $100 bill once in the backyard. And one time, an unopened bottle of Crown Royal in a little purple velvet bag survived the fall. So eventually, Pat's Grub Steak closed, and things quieted down a little bit. But people still sometimes, you know, pushed all of the furniture in their room out the windows. Those big, screenless, curtainless windows. They just tied the whole neighborhood together in a, this is a big fishbowl and somebody should change the water sort of way. But the water never changed. We just got new fish all the time. Different new fish. And on the other side of the Bergman, right, the uphill side, there's another 18 windows. And the people over there, they looked down into the windows, and they saw things that they'll never unsee. And at the top of the 3rd Street stairs, they actually could look down on the roof of the Bergman and wonder things like, why is there an entire moose carcass on the roof of the hotel? And we, you know, we lost parking spaces to the same burned-up couches, and we walked around the same broken hot water heaters, and I was just the closest cleaning up when ravens managed to push the moose bones off the roof. So this one January, there was about 2 feet of fresh snow downtown. And my wife worked evenings at the newspaper, at the Empire, and she called at 10:45 and said, I'll be home at 11. So just as I hang up the phone, I hear this woman's voice, and she goes, woohoo! And then I hear this dude go, "Say it again, baby." And she goes, "Woohoo!" And I go into the bathroom and I slide open the bathroom window and I look up. And in the fourth story window up there above me, there's a woman sitting in the windowsill. And she's looking, she's facing into the room, but I can see the back of her head and she's leaning back. And then I can see her back, you know, and she's leaning way back. And then I see her waist. She's leaning way back, and it's pretty obvious she's going to come out of the window, and she does. So she falls out the window and hits the roof, boom, right above my head. And then boom, 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 she rolls down through the snow, and bam, there she is, laid out, half naked, in the Slot Canyon, in the snow, completely KO'd. So I can tell you now that, you know, nothing was broken. She was just stunned. She was fine. So the windows slide up in the Bergman, and people are calling 911, and then this guy comes down, and he's like, got a lighter, right? And he's waving it in her face. He's going, "Hey, baby, are you okay?" And he's shaking her and stuff. And I'm like, "Don't shake her, don't shake her. Just get a blanket, put a blanket on her." So then all of a sudden, there's lights flashing off the side of the building and everything, and paramedics come, and they come down through the Slot Canyon with a stretcher, and they put her on it and strap her down, and she starts swinging and stuff, yelling, "Mose, Mose, what's happening, Mose?" So Mose is gone. And the paramedics are looking at me like... And then there's a knock at the door, and I go, and it's the police, right? And they want to know if she was pushed out the window. And I said, "Well, yeah, she was pushed out the window, and well, was it intentional?" And I said, "Well, no, I'm sure it wasn't intentional." And he's like, "Okay, fine." So I shut the door, and I'm just standing there in the living room looking at the door. And my wife walks in, and she says, "What?" I was like, "A lot can happen in 15 minutes. Thank you."
Listening to a Juno Afternoon.
This is Bird Note. Just outside Denver is a special bald eagle roost. The Rocky Mountain Arsenal National Wildlife Refuge is roughly the size of Manhattan. To the west, we can see the Rocky Mountains, and to the east, Denver International Airport. Here, the Army produced some of its dirtiest weapons, like napalm and sarin gas. Today, the arsenal is still a Superfund site, but it's also home to over 300 types of wildlife, including hundreds of species of birds. David Lucas, a project manager for the arsenal, takes us to the original roost that changed the course of this polluted landscape. It's a windy day on the prairie, and we can see a string of cottonwoods above an understory of prairie grasses.
In the 80s, the Rocky Mountain Arsenal, a former U.S. Army facility, was getting closed down, and they were trying to figure out its future. And lo and behold, a handful of eagles started utilizing these trees right over here. And at that time, remember, they were endangered. So it was a pretty amazing sight to see a handful of eagles that started using this. Those couple of eagles are probably the reason that this place became a national wildlife refuge.
Fast forward to now, and the eagles are flourishing. Two pairs live here year-round, and during the winter, up to 90 more migrate south to fish in the refuge's lakes. Discover more at birdnote.org. I'm Meredith Turk.
This show is made possible by the Falconer Family of Seattle, the Bobolink Foundation, the Treeline Foundation, and the Peg and Rick Young Foundation.
Thanks for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon. I'll be your host again tomorrow, and we will hear from the Alaska Society for Marine Mammalogy Student Chapter. We'll be hosting a Whale Watch fundraiser. And we'll also hear about STEM summer camps for kids on a Juno Afternoon. Looking at the weather, it is currently 52 degrees here in the capital city. Tonight's forecast calls for rain, with lows in the mid-40s and southeast winds to 20 miles per hour. Tomorrow, Tuesday, rain showers with highs in the mid-50s, southeast winds to 10 miles per hour. Thanks for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon.
Support for this station comes from listeners like you and Copa, a handcrafted ice cream and coffee shop serving organic Sentinel coffee and with a cart downtown during the summer season. Ice cream flavors, online ordering, and more at copa.biz.